Fourth, it is based on the principle that all members have a right to know what they are voting on and what the effect of their vote will be. Voting is really useless and without support and power if those who voted on the matter don't clearly understand their voting. They have a right to know. Fifth, it is based on the principle that all members have equal rights and privileges. They have the right to vote, to speak, to introduce motions, to nominate officers and to run for office, and in case of an adverse ruling by the chairperson, they have the right to go over his head to appeal to the assembly itself. The ultimate power rests not with the presiding officer, but with the assembly of the members. Sixth, although this one may sound a bit hard to believe, Robert's Rules of Order is based on the principle of doing everything as simply as possible. There are provisions for handling difficult situations, but for the most part, Robert's Rules of Order takes the rap for all those who attempt to use the system without knowing the system very well. When you know the system well, you realize that the procedures attempt to use the simplest procedures possible. Seventh, Robert's Rules of Order is based on a predetermined system for handling a meeting. In other words, individuals can't make up their own rules as they go along. That produces chaos, as the rules will constantly be changing, depending on who needs the rules changed for their own personal benefit. With Robert's Rules of Order, there is organization, order, and a proven method for productively and effectively running meetings. Finally, all of Robert's Rules of Order is undergirded by the principle of fairness. The rules are not for the benefit of a few. They attempt to bring forth a commitment to fairness on the part of all the members. Robert's Rules of Order is a system that has the members' best interest in mind, allows each member to have an equal say, and is committed to fairness. A proper understanding of its components will help you become a more effective officer in the organization or a more productive member. Some may object that this is a man-made system which leaves God out of the decision-making process. I believe this is a totally inaccurate and unfair statement. These people suggest that the situation must be an either-or, when in reality it is a both-and. God and a fair system of governance need not be mutually exclusive. Well, God doesn't say anything about Robert's Rules of Order in the Bible, so it must not be a good idea. Well, this is really absurd thinking. The Bible doesn't discuss automobiles, doesn't discuss airplanes, or air conditioning, or water skiing either. That doesn't mean these items are bad, or that God cannot be an integral part of them. To leave out the direction and guidance of the Holy Spirit is really a dangerous thing to do, no matter what the issue is. This truism is not limited only to Robert's Rules of Order. God is a God of order. He ordered the 6 days of creation in Genesis. The awesome universe he created really is an orderly system. And he desires order in the church. He established governments and rulers for the sake of order. Robert's Rules of Order is merely one attempt to align with a God who believes in order. Now, I am not suggesting that Robert's Rules of Order, in and of itself, is inspired of God or is the biblical system of running a meeting. There may be other ways. Without the infusion of the guidance and leadership of the Holy Spirit, Robert's Rules of Order is just another man-made system. But when God's guidance and direction is asked for and individuals are filled with the Spirit, Robert's Rules of Order can be very, very productive. Orderly and a great way of accomplishing God's desires. Now, it is not my intent here to advance a diatribe regarding the biblicalness of Robert's Rules of Order. It is certainly not anti-biblical, and I have seen it used of God to unite people in ways that otherwise would really not have occurred. I am saying that Robert's Rules of Order and the leading and guidance of the Holy Spirit need not be mutually exclusive of one another. How far does one carry Robert's Rules of Order? In other words, how strict of an adherence should there be? As a general rule, more formality and a greater degree of adherence is needed when the group is large. Small committee meetings may be much more informal, but an annual meeting involving 75 people obviously needs to pay greater attention to the system of order. Use general consent with all groups as much as possible. Obviously, there will rarely be 100% agreement 100% of the time, but there will be times of general consent. If the group is in general consent and no one disagrees, then there is no reason to take a formal vote. It is proper to ask if anyone disagrees or objects. If even one person does, then you do not have general consent. You should take a vote. General consent simply allows the meeting to progress faster without the formality of a vote. For instance, if there is a 5-minute limit for speakers, and the chair informs that particular person that the time is up, that person might say, "Mr. Chairman, may I have an extension of 2 minutes? That's all it will take for me to finish." Well, the chairman may say, "Is there an objection to Mr. Jones taking 2 more minutes? And if there is no objection, the chair would say, "Since there are no objections, the speaker may have an additional 2 minutes. This is operating by general consent. But if even one person objects, a formal vote will have to be taken. The same can be done with the motion to adjourn. Now, you don't need a motion if there is no other business. The chair would simply say, "There being no further business, are there any objections to adjournment?" Pause and give individuals time to respond, and if there are no objections, then say, "If not, we stand adjourned." It must be pointed out that general consent should only be used in non-controversial matters. Controversial matters should always require formal voting. If your church or organization has been lax with the adherence to good meeting standards, it is wise to slowly bring these into place. The pastor can't get up at the annual meeting and say, "You know, we've been slacking far too much with Robert's Rules of Order these last few annual meetings, and it's high time we had some order around here." Well, obviously this could be offensive to the members, as you've just told them how bad and how wrong all of their past meetings were. Besides, if the pastor doesn't have a handle on Robert's Rules of Order, the role of the fool is played in public. It is far better to implement stricter adherence to standards over a period of time, educating the people and the leadership along the way. This will give you time to learn the standards yourself and allow the people to see the productive benefit that a few changes can make. For any meeting to be legal and binding, a quorum of members must be present. The bylaws of a church or organization often specify this. It is usually the majority of the members. Since church membership roles are often larger than the regular attending and involve members, only active members should be allowed to vote. The bylaws should state the requirements for active membership and how that determination may be made. Since all the members don't usually show up, a majority may be hard to come by. That's why in some bylaws, the number for a quorum is the number of people who might reasonably be expected to come to the meeting. Other bylaws simply state that however many members show up at the given meeting constitutes a quorum. So a quorum is usually a majority of the membership, but may be further defined in the bylaws of the organization. In the absence of a quorum, no legal meeting can be held. The only motion that may be entertained is the motion to adjourn. Now, people can hang around and talk, but no business may be discussed or acted upon. If it is an emergency situation, the group may meet, but their actions must later be ratified by the entire group at a later time. If it is not ratified, then the meeting was a waste of time. An absence of a quorum has occurred several times to me with planned meetings for the entire governing board. These meetings were regular once-a-month meetings scheduled far in advance, so all members could make the necessary arrangements to attend. Meetings were promptly adjourned when a quorum was not present. I think this is best, except, of course, in the case of an emergency, but I think it's best for the following reasons. First, to enter into discussion without the rest of the members present is to function without the full potential of ideas and issues that could be brought to light if more members were present. Why spend 2 hours discussing an issue, arriving at a decision, only to find that at the next meeting someone who wasn't at the previous meeting brings up a point no one thought of that thrusts a reconsideration of the previous decision? You end up discussing things twice, and that, in my opinion, is a waste of time. The full flow of discussion is interrupted. Second, meeting without a quorum sets a bad precedent. It devalues the meetings and holds people to less of a standard. If you don't expect members to be there, many of them won't come. Everyone should know the order of business during the meeting. This helps individual members know where they started and where they're going. Meetings often start off with a ceremony or a tradition, or in the case of the church, prayer. To bring about a closer sense of community and oneness, I would often expand this during smaller group meetings, such as governing board meetings. We often sang a few choruses. We often asked for a time of testimony, and then we oftentimes broke into groups of twos or threes for prayer. And I found that this softened individuals and reminded them that they were brothers and sisters in the family of God, and the meeting should be conducted as such. Normally, the reading of the minutes is next on the agenda. This becomes the official record of motions made and actions taken. The secretary is the one who usually handles this task. It is best to hand these minutes out prior to the meeting for smaller groups so individuals may read them beforehand. The chairperson should ask if there are any corrections. If not, then it should stand approved as read or written. If there are corrections, they should be noted. Often someone moves and seconds the adoption of the minutes, and this is really unnecessary. All the chairman has to say is, the minutes stand approved as read, or the minutes stand approved as corrected. I remember one particular person during one of my pastorates who included everything everyone ever said about everything and anything in the minutes. And the minutes were long, they were single-spaced, typed in all caps, with no indentation. And needless to say, it made my eyes go cross-eyed. There are some helpful hints for the recording of minutes that saves everyone time and captures the important aspects of the meeting. First, generally speaking, minutes should be limited to statements of decisions that were made, problems that are still open, and actions that need to be taken before the next meeting. No more of, Bob said this, Mary said this, Joe brought up this point, and I thought it best to speak on so-and-so. Only record what is essential. Second, use a time-saving code. Each committee or board should number their minutes. This is of immense value. Everyone can find their place and determine which minute is being referred to simply by stating its number. Number the minutes consecutively. In other words, if the minutes of the first meeting, number 1 through 15, the minutes of the second meeting should begin with number 16. This way, we know precisely which point a person is referring to simply by the number. We don't have to talk about that thing we discussed sometime last spring. For groups dealing with overseeing several other committees, it is wise to label each of the minutes according to its proper category. A decision that deals with Christian education can have a CE in front of it. Business and finance could have a BF, missions, MI, music, MU, and so on. Additionally, don't record the names of those who moved and seconded the motion. Use the time-saving code MS and MSC. MS indicates the motion was made, seconded, but did not carry. MSC indicates that the motion was made, seconded, and carried. Time saving involves both the person preparing the minutes and those reading them. Someone may have all the time in the world to prepare minutes, but the person reading them may not have the same amount of time. These time-saving measures keep it simple for all involved. Finally, I believe it is appropriate to include who is responsible to carry out the decision if it is not stated directly in the motion. All too often, a board agrees on something in the conference room, but no one carries it to completion. The chairperson should make certain that this is done. For instance, a motion that the trustees examine the cost of installing a handicap ramp and present the best options to the board in 2 months is very specific. We know who is to do it and when it will get done. This motion, however, is ambiguous, that we look into selling the old bus so our youth might be able to get a 14-passenger van. Well, who will look into it? Who will see that it is done? When will they report back? Who will they report back to? It is likely that this kind of motion will sit on the back burner for months, as everyone says, "That's not my responsibility." Be sure to somehow note who is responsible for follow-through. Third, personalize the minutes for every member. This, of course, couldn't be done for a large number of people, but it helps make people feel important. It makes them feel needed and appreciated when they receive their personal copy. The report of standing committees comes next. A standing committee is one established by the bylaws, such as the treasurer. A standing committee can be any committee at all that is established by the bylaws. I've seen all kinds, from the music committee, the missions committee, the deaconess committee, and a host of others. With the treasurer's report, no action is required. It is technically improper to move and approve it unless it has been audited. If it hasn't been audited, there is no way we can be assured of its content. The annual report of the treasurer, however, is audited. Thus, one approves the auditor's report. Approving a proposed budget is a different matter altogether. Make corrections to the treasurer's report, but it is a waste of time to move, second, and approve this report since its accuracy has not been established by an auditor. After the standing committee reports comes the special committee reports. These committees have been established for planning or accomplishing a task. This would include, for instance, a pastoral search committee, a committee gathering information about the cost of building a handicapped ramp, or a committee charged with presenting a cost-effective plan for refurnishing the kitchen. This is followed by unfinished business. Some refer to this as old business, which is fine. I like unfinished business better because old tends to reflect unimportant, boring business when, in actuality, it refers to matters pending or postponed. This is followed by new business. Obviously, this is self-explanatory. And this is followed by pertinent announcements. Finally, adjournment is in order. And this is the general order of most business meetings. This is the end of number 7.